I think we all realize the importance of peace. And I think of Christ when he said, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world gives, give I unto you." And I think, unfortunately, those who are warmongers don't know anything about peace. Peace without, and certainly not peace within themselves. We come before you today with heavy hearts. I think all of us have heavy hearts when we think of what's going on. As we fight for peace in a troubled world, we realize there are people who do not know what peace is. But we will not be discouraged. We will continue until that peace that Christ left with us will be a reality. It is unfortunate that men in high places have gone beyond their best judgment to place the power of destruction instead of having left the peace. What is the reason any head of a country would go against his or her own people to approve and join the wishes of evildoers to destroy people, including babies, old and young people, even the sick, blind, and the helpless people, many who have been beaten into submission and are still suffering in Iraq? Even the unborn are affected of what went on during the reign of the administration of the senior Bush. What are these people got to lose, and why do they go along? And it is only just to get along. It's what are they expecting out of getting along with evil? I feel that many of these people are being bribed. But what is it worth to be bribed when those whom you represent don't know anything about it in order that they can put them out of office? They are, to me, nothing but cowards and traitors. They are unaware, no doubt, that their country may be next for the slaughterhouse. Nobody respects a coward, for he either lets someone else think for him, or he refuses to depend upon his own judgment, his right, and he knows nothing about justice. Slavery is not dead. Like modernization in all things, slavery is in the minds of people who are being used, and gladly or not, they are willing to go along just to get along. And by that, they have some intention, even if it is greed, bribery, kindness, or whatever it might be. And they are determined to be used in order that they may get whatever there is in it for just them. The coward people are being used by those who operate a section, a place, or country for their own personal use. They are even bribing. Did I say bribing? Yes, bribing. George Bush has offered millions of dollars to other countries for their help, even Turkey, whom he has in line to attack after he gets through with Iraq. Many people were brought to America to build and to make it what it is today. They were made cowards to produce and to give their labor, and it is done now through harassment, antagonizing, confusion, threatening, and even fear and frustration. Isn't that terrorism? I consider it terrorism. I know what it is because I lived with it and I lived among it for over 50 years. The whole world is affected by the build-up to go into Iraq and to conquer the world by a group that is rather small. Then it is up to us to do something about it. The military that they have is far above that of the small country that they are going into. In fact, 10 times as large. While George Bush has pushed God and is calling for blood, yes, more human blood, some people are seeking a true leader, and this leader is called by God. He's called by God to lead the world out of this disturbance. This is a man who many of you know and who needs no introduction. He is a man who has fought, who has given his life, or he has been exposed, in fact, to many things, but he has come out more than conqueror. Lyndon LaRouche is a man that the axis of evil, or similar to that, has tried for many years to destroy him, even putting him in prison, operating on him physically, operating on him one day, and getting him out of his sick bed at 4 o'clock and have him go to KP duty. They have done everything that is possible to destroy him. But when God is with you, no man can be against you. And we know that God is with him through those trials and crosses and even what he is going through now. And he is still standing tall to fight for you and for me in order that we may be able to have peace in this world. Will we listen and take his advice? God will not come down to warn us of what will happen and what to do. He speaks only through people. And I present to you and this humble servant who has worked for us, who will work for us, and who does not fear death. Because he knows that there is a duty, and someone has to do it. And he knows, by the way he lives, that he will be held up by the hands of God to do his work. For God does not come down, but he only works through people, and those are people whom he has selected. And this gentleman has been selected to lead us from darkness into light. I present to some of you and introduce to others the greatest man we've got to lead us and show us the way from darkness to light, Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Kind of Shakespearean farce in which the president is playing the role of King Lear and the vice president that of Lady Macbeth. But this is a very serious matter. Sometimes fools will do what others will not do. And sometimes he wishes to have a great crime committed, find a fool to do it. Because he won't shrink from it, because he doesn't know any better. Like this poor prince, who sincerely does not know what he's doing, has no idea what the reality is in which he's operating. What we have to understand is that in this tragedy, as in all classical tragedies, in all true tragedies in history, the root of disaster is not leaders of the people. It is not leading institutions. It is the people themselves who bring disaster upon themselves by selecting leaders or by supporting leaders who are the agents of that disaster. That's what the Greek tragedy teaches. That's what Shakespeare teaches. That's what Schiller teaches. That's truth. Therefore, when we come to a time of crisis, the people must first of all examine themselves. And when studying the misleaders, they must look inside themselves to find the error by which they are become complicit in the evil work done by those leaders. What is happening to us today in the world came as no surprise to me. I've been aware of this more or less clearly for more than 40 years. I saw the things that happened in particular at the end of the war. I was a soldier in the war. I saw the transformation of those with whom I served in the immediate period following the war. I saw the Truman era, which was an era of evil, succeeding a heroic era, that of Franklin Roosevelt. I saw among those who had shown the courage of soldiers in war, that when they returned to their homes in the United States, very soon, within a year or two, they capitulated to fears. They capitulated to the pressure of their wives. They capitulated to their own fears. The fear that if they said the wrong thing, if they didn't say what was expected of them, in the period of the so-called U.S.-Soviet conflict, that they would be crushed. They would lose employment. Their families would suffer. They wouldn't realize the goals of raising a family. And so they crawled. And about 90% of the Moors who returned as soldiers crawled. They adopted the habit of crawling throughout the late 1940s and 1950s. They crawled. They degraded themselves. They taught their children to be careful, to learn how to adapt in life, to learn how to degrade themselves. And then they got through because Truman was replaced by Eisenhower. And that was important. That was his gain. Truman was a very evil man. He was a stupid little man, but an evil one. And the reason we got rid of him was to save the country from what he represented. And because Eisenhower had been a general who represented the American military tradition, and since the followers of Churchill and of Truman represented a new tradition, an evil one, Eisenhower was a period of stability and regroupment for the American people. At the moment he died, or died of office, hell broke loose. We had the Cuba Missile Crisis, we had the Bay of Pigs, the Cuba Missile Crisis, the assassination of President Kennedy, which is part of the pattern. He was not killed by Oswald. He was killed by a special operation inside our country called the Special Warfare Section, which does these kinds of things. Then we were plunged into the Vietnam War under Johnson. Johnson was responsible. It was done as part of a process. And from that time on, we were headed toward hell. Not immediately, but down the road. We were headed to degeneration. Degeneration represented by the Vietnam War. Degeneration represented by the rock, drug, sex, counterculture, which corrupted much of the youth entering university level at that time. They have not yet recovered from that effect. We were transformed step by step from the most productive society on the planet, the greatest rate of productivity per capita in the world. We were transformed into a parasitical consumer society, really by our power to extract concessions from other parts of the world. We looted the world to feed ourselves and said we were better off because we had gone to a consumer society. We destroyed the instinct for honest work in our people, an instinct for getting money, even living on credit cards rather than earn money. Because debt crushed you. We became corrupt. Our culture became corrupt. Our entertainment became rotten. Our economic practices rotten. The universities today are barely recognizable as the institutions of learning. In our schools, we don't show people, we don't educate people anymore, rarely. We rehearse them to pass multiple choice questionnaires, prepared questionnaires. We score those, the answers to those questionnaires by computer. The students know nothing. They have learned to pass the questionnaire. And the students are not rewarded for passing the questionnaire. The student institutions are rewarded, relatively. The state is rewarded. Officials rewarded for this corruption. We have people coming out of the universities who don't know anything. But they've got degrees. They're professionally regarded. We don't make things anymore. We have benchmarking. We fire the engineers who are the experimental engineers and replace them by engineers who run computers. They go into the computer schemes and they pull out formulas from the computer. They paste these formulas together and they tell you that's an automobile, which turns over fine at over 45 miles an hour. Make any. We produce things that don't work. You go into the stores in the United States, for example. We are mostly junk. Not goods of the type we were proud to own years ago. Junk. Produced by virtual slave labor in various parts of the world. That's our condition. We become morally decadent. And because we allowed ourselves to become morally decadent in this and related ways, we are now being punished by the kind of leadership we have selected to guide us into this maw of degradation. So we got George Bush. How we got him is rather interesting. Maybe his father could explain, or maybe the mother's responsible. They don't know. But we got him because it was decided that no person qualified for the office of president would be allowed to run credibly for that office in the year 2011. We had Al Gore, who was more dangerous than George Bush. He would have had us in war 6 months ago or a year ago. He's a captain of the same people that are controlling George Bush today. George Bush is a man of no confidence, whose understanding of geography is more, less than limited. And who has problems, honest problems. But we put a man into office, and the alternative we put in the office was equally incompetent. We put an incompetent in the top executive position of the U.S. government at a point the world was already plunging into the worst crisis in modern history. He's going to make the decisions. Of course he's not going to make the decisions. He's a puppet. A puppet full of emotions and loose strings which are pulled to make him do what he wishes to do. Now I'm trying to make this clear. But I also try to make clear in discussing tragedy that a time of tragedy is a time of a search for the sublime. When a people discovers that it's been behaving as a fool for a long period of time, And that foolishness brings it to a point where it is doomed by its own foolishness, its own foolish opinions, its own foolish assumptions about what's good and what's wrong. At that time, the people face a great crisis. They face a great threat. And if the threat is bad enough, maybe they ask themselves, what did we do wrong? As long as they blame the leaders, they will not find the answer. When they blame themselves, a cure is available. Because they have to find that in themselves which led them to walk the road toward degradation. This has always been the case in history. That mankind has never really grown up. In all civilizations, great ventures have been made in the creation of state. Some of these things are memorable as achievements, but then they degenerate in the fashion that Solon writes in his letter, his poem that he writes toward the end of his life, in telling the Athenians how they had degenerated years after he had led them to freedom. This is the history of mankind. Great ventures of nationhood come forth and they degenerate. And the people like it. They become accustomed to it. It becomes their way of life, their opinion. Another time of crisis comes. And the question is, can they discover their honor? Can they discover truth? And change the way they think in order to change the way they behave? And that's how mankind has often renewed itself. Because the sublime has come to recognition not only that what they've been doing is wrong, but that there, if they look for answers, there may be available answers. There may be teachers and leaders who will provide these answers and these instructions. And thus nations have saved themselves. Typical of the case of Franklin Roosevelt. From 1901, when the British and others assassinated President McKinley, until 1932, when Roosevelt was elected in the general election, the United States was predominantly in a process of regeneration. Theodore Roosevelt was an heir and an ideologue of the defeated Confederacy. And that's what he represented, degeneracy. He would have been a fascist if he hadn't bought this longer time to complete his work. There was an interval of Taft, President Taft, an Ohio Republican, who was not so bad. But then we had another fascist, Woodrow Wilson, who was the person who founded or refounded the Ku Klux Klan in the United States from the White House. That was the president, the Ku Klux Klan president in the White House. Europe had some experience with this gentleman. Then we had Harding, who was a mixed bag. Then we had Coolidge, who was not a mixed bag. He was evil. And we had the apparatus that put Coolidge into power, controlled the Hoover administration, up to virtually the point that Roosevelt was inaugurated in 1933. So we have 22 years of degeneration of the United States. And fortunately at that time, Franklin Roosevelt, whose great-grandfather had been a collaborator of Alexander Hamilton, would call upon this side of his patriotic family tradition as governor of New York State to lead the United States out of hell by winning an election for the cause of the common man, or the so-called forgotten man, who had been abused in this 32 years under Teddy Roosevelt, Wilson, Coolidge, and Hoover. He turned the United States back to itself. Back to the principles upon which it founded, the principles of Abraham Lincoln, the principles of John Quincy Adams, and we renewed ourselves as Lincoln had renewed us again with his presidency. That these are examples of the sublime, where leaders come from a nation, from within a nation, to lead it out of its own degradation by providing answers which the nation is willing to listen to at that moment of crisis. We are now again in such a situation. Since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which is a part who is committed to going back to the Franklin Roosevelt tradition, the United States has gone through a long process of degeneration, more deeply in some respects than ever before in our national history. And thus we were given two candidates for president, leading candidates for president, in the year 2000, who fit the desires of the American people, either by wish or by negligence. And what we're suffering today in the United States and around the world is a result of that choice, that negligence by the people of the United States themselves, and also the people in Europe. We see what happened recently in the case of the German Chancellor and the French President. It's a horror which is being presented to them. The combination of a world depression and the threat of a general outbreak of warfare, global warfare, not just Iraq, horrified them to the point that the French, the German Chancellor, the Russian President formed what became known as the so-called European Triangle, of resistance to what was coming out of the United States. Resistance because they recognized that this was not a war against Iraq, as the French Prime Minister, the French Foreign Minister said in the UN proceedings. This was a war against civilization. It was an expression of an American policy, a U.S. policy, which was a threat to civilization as a whole. Now let me just take it from there and indicate how the story goes from there. About the 27th of January 2001, on the eve of the inauguration of President George Bush, I made a broadcast by network, broadcast by the video network, of an estimate report on what would happen under an inaugurated President George Bush. I pretty much forecast what has happened today. I did not know of September 11th, 2001, but I forecast it in a certain manner of speaking, the following way. Let's go back to Germany, 1928-1933. We had in 1928 the fall of the Mueller government, which was a reflection of an onrushing global financial crisis, economic crisis, hitting Germany with such rehearsals, especially under foreign domination of the Versailles powers. No one solved the problem. 1931, there was an understanding of what the solution was, but it wasn't implemented. It came to 1932-33. The other chancellor, von Schleicher, who under optimal conditions could have been an effective chancellor to prevent the war. Why? Because Franklin Roosevelt had been elected in November 1932. In the same period, approximately, that von Schleicher was appointed the ministerial chancellor of Germany. If von Schleicher had not been overthrown, then he would have filled in chancellor at the time that Roosevelt was actually inaugurated President of the United States in March of 1933. So had von Schleicher been the Chancellor of Germany in March 1933, the United States and Germany would have been cooperating on the policies like those of Franklin Roosevelt internationally. There would have been no world war. What intervened was is that a group of forces based on the former head of the Bank of England from Britain and his partner, the Harriman family, and the grandfather of the present President of the United States, President Bush, moved the money, which is American-controlled money, under British direction to save the Nazi Party and Hitler from oblivion, which they had deserved at that point. Not only was the Nazi Party in Hitler's position, Hitler was thinking of suicide. Not only were they saved from oblivion, but on the 28th of January, 1933, von Schleicher was thrown out under pressure on Hindenburg and became the Chancellor on the 30th of January. A short time after that, in March, the Nazis organized what was called the Reichstagsfeier. Immediately there was implemented an act crafted by the man who had created, probably you will hear about it from me a bit more here, Leo Strauss. This Kauschmidt had crafted no problem. The implementation of that on the circumstances of the Reichstag fire made Hitler a dictator. And from that event and what followed with the wave of assassinations during the period, same period, summer of 1934, World War II was inevitable. There was no force on the planet that was going to stop it. All that stopped it was, all we could do was prepare for it. Now, we're not in such a bad situation today, but that's the situation now. What I forecast in my telecast on the 27th of January of 2001 was that we were in a situation today where by the year 2000, the United States was already in a hyperinflationary moment. That is, the rate of money being printed or issued in other ways to roll over bankrupt financial assets was such that we were in a hyperinflationary spiral. That meant that the post-war system, especially the system of the post-1971 floating exchange rate system, was now at an end phase. It was doomed. Nothing could have saved this financial system then or now. The IMF in its present form cannot survive. If it does survive, then the human race won't survive. So I said then, in January, that's where we were. Therefore, we would expect, given what the Bush administration is, what the forces were involved, that we have to expect not only a depression, an accelerating depression, which has accelerated, in fact, since then, it was already in process earlier, but that we had to look for the occurrence of a Reichstag fire-like event, a terrorist event which we use as a pretext to bring an emergency government into power in the United States, which would then launch war or a warlike posture in order to attempt to control the political situation by worldwide warfare rather than facing the economic crisis. Now, there's some people who think that the war against Iraq is a war against Iraq. It is not a war against Iraq. It is a war against the pretext of Iraq to start a world war. The purpose behind this is a world war, not a right war. If you don't stop it, there is no after Iraq war. The Iraq war will never end. The destruction of Iraq may occur within the next days or weeks, but the Iraq war will never end because it will be going into another war under an administration which is totally committed to a worldwide fascist imperialism. I'll be made clear what that is. Therefore, we must stop it. This war is not inevitable. Its continuation is not inevitable. We must stop it. Those who say let's accept a liberal war and try to clean up afterwards are fools. There is no afterwards. There's only a continuing war. You could expect the bombing of North Korea to occur almost automatically in the context of this. It is not stopped. And it won't stop there. Iran is on the target list already. And this war could spill into Iran already. The war will explode throughout the Middle East if it continues. It cannot be stopped unless the war as a whole is stopped. China is one of the nations targeted by this war. which gives you some sense of what the dimensions are, what we're up against. We must stop this war. There's a positive side to the situation. I referred to it already, the so-called European triumph. The fear which has struck Europe, and the positive response we have already from Chirac, as well as his foreign minister, from the Chancellor in Germany, from others, and from Russia. I think a very positive shift in Russia's response. Means that the world recognizes there's a danger that must be stopped. We also have at the same time a recognition of crises and problems in East Asia, South Asia, and Southeast Asia. Recognized among nations which are composed of the so-called strategic triangle of Russia, China, and India. That is a triangle of nations which, if they agree to cooperate, represent a fulcrum of stability, both economic stability and general security for the entire area of Asia. This includes also the North Asian complex of the Korean, the two parts of Korea, which should be unified to one degree or another. It also includes that part of China, which is adjacent to Korea. It includes part of Russia. It includes also the industrial forces in Japan who are opposed to the warlike policy of the present Prime Minister. These forces know they need a recovery program. They know that a recovery program and cooperation is the only force of resistance against this spreading war. There are forces in Europe, as well as in Asia, who recognize the importance of closer ties and cooperation, especially economically based, on technology transfer relations of the long term between Western Europe and Asia. These things must occur now. Therefore, this is a force for the good. The issue is, how do we make this force for good, this potential force for good? How do we make it effective? First of all, how do we make it a conscious factor in the minds of people around the world? It exists. Some people in Russia, as well as in Germany and France, know it exists. Some in China, some in Korea, some in Japan. Some in India will appreciate the importance of this opportunity. But that's not enough. Public opinion, even good public opinion, will never stop a horror show or solve a problem. Someone has to pull the strings of power to make it conscious and make it happen. And that's what I'm determined to do. To pull the strings of power. Not to spread good opinion. Not to spread good information. But to touch people inside, to cause those in positions of leadership to act, as they must act. Because the people will respond to action from appropriate leaders. The people may have opinion. Look at the anti-war opinion around the world. Does it stop the war? It does not stop the war. Is it useful? Yes, it's useful. Will it stop a war? It will not stop a war. No peace movement could ever stop a war. Even though it may be useful. Somebody has to pull the strings of power to set into motion the action around which popular opinion can then mobilize and grow. And be mobilized for what? For action. Not for negative action, but for positive action. The positive action, of course, is to create a new international monetary financial system. To take the IMF and put it into bankruptcy reorganization. To bring nations together to do that. To create a just new world economic order by agreeing to form a new monetary system based on certain principles of cooperation which are acceptable among the participating nations. Not one nation or two nations to give the answers to the world, but an assembly of leading nations of the world who agree on certain principles to govern a new monetary system whose immediate goal is to lead the world out of the present depression. The mobilization of a hopeful humanity for recovery from this horror show is the one thing that can stop the war. Yet other action is necessary. But the will to act by the people and by institutions depends upon an initiative which is given by leadership. Popular opinion will never save civilization. It can destroy it, but it will never save it. It requires, in this day and age, until mankind grows up more generally, mankind will continue to depend upon the intervention of leading circles who are capable of resolve to make sure that what happened will happen for the sake of humanity. And in those circumstances, we find a humanity relieved from such a crisis does respond. Not always, but usually. Therefore, what's the problem here? I said the problem is the assumptions of popular opinion by which the people and nations have so far destroyed themselves, especially during the past 40 years in Europe, the Americas, and elsewhere. What does that mean? That means don't trust your own independent thinking. You probably don't have any actually independent thinking, but you delude yourself that you do. Because you have seen people doing things generation after generation. In the post-war period, and especially in the past 40 years, doing things which have led this civilization to self-destruction. So obviously, what people usually think is wrong. And therefore, independent thinking is not independent thinking. Something is controlling the way they think and act, which is causing them to do the things that lead to the destruction of civilization. That is what Solon warned the Athenians against as Athens began to degenerate during his later years of life. Independent thinking is not valid because it's not independent. Independent thinking means blinding yourself to false assumptions which are controlling your opinion. In the same sense that a Cartesian geometry specializes certain definitions, axioms, and postulates as the basis for a formal geometry, an ivory tower geometry. Now, this geometry is false. It does not correspond to the real world, to the real physical world. But anyone who believes it is a fool. But they will pass the course if they believe it. They will come to a conclusion based on this geometry and say, that is my own independent opinion. It is not their independent opinion. It is an opinion they formed because they accepted certain taught definitions, axioms, and postulates. And they are controlled by those assumptions. I'll get to free trade here in a moment and indicate how that works. So therefore, the problem today is you've got to not only question the assumptions of nations and governments, but you've got to question your own assumptions and hesitate a moment before you leap to a conclusion about what the problem is or what the solution is. Because your conclusion will probably be wrong unless you examine the false assumptions which have heretofore controlled the way you think what you call your independent opinion. Therefore, we come to the question of absence. Now, let's start the fun. Have we got a screen here? What I'm going to do is demonstrate just offhand. What, did you stick them down? Oh, it's not going to hit me. Oh. Shot me in the house. Look out of the That's not mine. Okay. This is probably familiar to a number of you, but what I'm going to do is demonstrate exactly how elementary a piece of foolishness has dominated the so-called independent thinking of most people in North America and Europe, okay, over the past 30 years. What we're representing here is again, this is a pedagogical chart. This is not an actual statistical chart, but it's a pedagogical approximation. On the far left, what you're looking at is approximately the year 1956 in Britain, the United Kingdom, and in the United States. What you're seeing over here approximately is the present. What has happened over this period is that in terms of the process, the degeneracy of the present world monetary financial system, its economic degeneracy, has taken the form of an increase in per capita, per square kilometer quantity of so-called financial banks, market banks, so-called. If you believe in the market, well, things don't like to think about the market. Then the second one we're looking at is a monetary aggregate. We'll keep this chart in position. This one. Monetary aggregate, that is the amount of money which is being generated, or equivalent of money, which is being generated to pump the financial markets. Those markets have not grown because productivity has increased, quite the contrary. Markets have grown because money is being pumped into financial markets, and this increase of money then generates marginally, by leverage, it generates an increase in financial aggregates, even if there's no real increase in debt. The third is a declining trend per capita and per square kilometer in terms of physical assets, including infrastructure, produced and available. That has been the tendency in the Americas and Europe, and has its effects on not only Africa, but also Asia. And Japan in particular. Japan is also the same kind of thing. Japan is the economy being destroyed by exactly this kind of process. Now, let's go to the next page. Now, in this case, this represents the year 2000. Let me describe exactly what happened about this year 2001. In 1998, there was an end of the bubble being pumped up worldwide, which had been based largely upon looting the former Soviet Union and countries which had been part of the Commonwealth. So that looting had occurred on a massive scale, partly under the friends of Andropov, his survivors, in the late 1980s. It had accelerated greatly with the fall of Soviet power, and had continued under the new generation of thieves, under Yeltsin, into the year 1998. So this looting had reached the sort of limit, and the last gasp of the effort was by the Vice President of the United States, who was an asset of Mark Rich and Al Gore. And Al Gore had entered into a dirty relationship to the Yeltsin re-election campaign, which is called Golden Ada, which is dirty diamonds, dead people all over the place, that kind of thing. You'd be using kind of gangster operation. So, this had been, the operation had been done with a Crown of New York, long-term capital management association, which had used derivatives to try to take this phony paper being generated under Yeltsin in Russia, and to give it apparent value through marketing it by through these long-term derivatives, financial derivatives. In August of 1998, that bubble collapsed. The Federal Reserve System was stepped in massively to save the U.S. financial system from a collapse of the hedge funds which have been involved in this operation. At that point, people around Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton himself said, I guess I can say it now. He was right, pointing to me. You guys are wrong. So he announced it as it became public in September of 1998. He went to New York to the Council on Foreign Relations and announced to them that he was committed at that point to a reform of the international monetary system, which a reform which had been prompted at my suggestion. He and his Treasury Secretary, Bob Rubin, thought they could get it through. They soon found out about what the meaning of von Walensky in the basement was, because the great scandal was run, the impeachment scandal, to try to get Clinton out, and Clinton was therefore stopped by the impeachment scandal for proceeding with negotiating monetary reform. That's real history. So at that point, what they did in New York, with the aid of George Soros, who's also a thief and a drug pusher, they agreed that the way to solve the problem, because they had a Brazil crisis coming up in February 1999, and they said, how are we going to get through the Brazil crisis on top of the present crisis? And George Soros said, wall of money. Print money. Generate money in all forms, quickly. Flood the world with money. And by flooding the world with enough money, that is monetary aggregate, you can prevent the financial collapse from occurring. Well, that's exactly what did occur for the time being. That's what this represents. In 1999, we have the first indication that the amount of money being pumped into the system to roll over threatened financial assets exceeded the amount of the financial assets being rolled over. Now that is an impression in German history, 1923, June to November of 1923, the great hyperinflationary explosion. And that's what that represents. Now, because the United States was able to loot a lot of countries, which Germany could not do in 1923, the United States and others have been able to moderate the effect of this, but since that time, this process has been ongoing. In the year 2000, about the spring of 2000, I went through the figures again with my associates. And we determined that this was not simply an episodic phenomenon, not a surge, but that this was a permanent part of the process. That this system would not survive except in this form, in which the amount of monetary aggregate being pumped in would exceed the amount of financial aggregate being rolled over. That meant was the termination of the system. Let's go to the next one. What you've seen previously were the idealized representation, the pedagogical representation. These are some of the actual figures from clause 23 of what we need to about the same. Let's go there. Now, what the effects of this, and this covers 1977 to approximately the present, was as a result of the changes inside the United States, there has been, in terms of family income levels, the lower 80% of the families of the United States have been suffering a major shift in the percentile of the national income owned by the, received by the lower 80%, and also, in fact, the loss of the Jews. So, but not only that, is that the physical amount, the physical value of the income of the average family in the United States in the lower 80% has collapsed physically, absolutely, as well as relatively to the total population. So what we had is a destruction, a physical destruction of the U.S. economy, and a physical destruction of the conditions of life of the lower 80% of the U.S. population. What does this say? Many of you have been exposed to courses in economics in universities or someplace else, or newspaper columns. They tell you that money, that the market is what's important, that the improvement of financial assets, we can put this to one side. The increase of financial assets and the yield on bonds, stocks, bonds, and so forth on the financial market is a measure of health. They will tell you that the amount of money being circulated is a measure of health, financial health, or economic health. For this entire period, most of the world has believed that the United States and Europe were in excellent condition because of the amount of money in circulation, the amount of financial profit reported in markets up until recent years, and similar kinds of things. It was all fraud. There was never any truth to it. because the physical value of the total product of these economies per capita and per square kilometer was collapsing. And the collapse was not an accidental or incidental collapse, it was a systemic collapse. That is, the way the system was designed to operate was inherently destroying the level of actual physical income, the physical standard of living per capita, per square kilometer in all these nations. So therefore, if you believe in monetary theory, if you believe in John Maynard Keynes, if you believe in financial systems, financial economy, you're an idiot. Because you are operating upon assumptions, axiomatic assumptions, which had no correspondence to reality. So you would come up here with your own independent thinking about how the financial market is operating, about how to make money in business, and similar kinds of things based on monetary and financial theory. And to the extent that you believe that, your so-called independent opinion was less than worthless. It was junk. Let's go to some more of these things. First of all, let's take something that some of the young people here are quite familiar with. The question of Gauss's 1799 paper on the subject of the fundamental theorem of algebra, which was an attack upon two of the so-called leading mathematicians of the 18th century and early 19th century, Leonhard Euler and Lagrange, among others. They were wrong. They made the same kind of mistake, which Gauss corrected. But some people haven't corrected it to this day. They're still teaching Lagrange ideas. They're still ideas of Euler today. Their opinion, independent opinion, is controlled by a false axiom, by false definitions. Axioms and postulates. Their opinion is worthless. It's less than worthless. It's dangerous. So when we started the youth movement, the question for me was, how do we organize the efforts of development among the youth? And I answered with Gauss at one of our conferences when this question came up. Because what Gauss represents is two things in this particular case, but also in this case. What Gauss represents is a principle of truth. That there is knowable truth in the universe. That there is the possibility of a competent, independent opinion. But it has to be based on and derived from a principle of truth. Principles of truth which have universal application. So I said, we'll take this as a principle of truth. Now here's the implication. What Gauss did was essentially what had been done in the time of Plato by a student of the follower of the school of Pythagoras and Plato on the question of the doubling of the line, the doubling of the square, and the doubling of the cube, the Darian problem. What this demonstrated, compare this with this financial bookkeeping thing, what this demonstrated is that the standard of truth cannot be determined mathematically. There is no such thing as simple, pure mathematical truth. It doesn't exist. There is a truth in mathematics, which is already demonstrated in classical Greek cases, as in these particular ancient cases to which Gauss's work refers. And what Gauss had done, like some people before him, such as Kuza, Brunelleschi, Leonardo da Vinci, Kepler, Leibniz, and so forth, what he had done was simply revise classical Greek knowledge and principles after a long period of Latin degeneration. Because the prevailing opinion and knowledge of Europe had been degenerating ever since the rise of Rome, in which these ideas of classical ideas, which had persisted up until 200 BC and even somewhat later, were being crushed by the introduction of a Roman way of thinking. which would have been the consistent problem of our civilization since that time. Then in the 15th century, with the Renaissance, there was a rebirth of this kind of classical knowledge from this ancient period of classical Greece. And what Gauss did was essentially, in modern terms, with modern evidence and modern science, recreated the foundations in that work and other works that he did, the foundations for a restoration of classical knowledge of the ancient Greek type. The classical knowledge based on a Platonic principle of truth. Now the reason what I did with this was to say that I've got a bunch of young people who wish to go someplace and looking to me to give them some signposts in which direction to get there. Therefore, the first thing they have to know, they have to have, is a principle of truth. To sort out all this nonsense that's floating around, to come up with some standard of how do I know what I'm talking about? How do I come up with a competent form of independent opinion? With the idea that if you can proceed from that, you can then, you have a principle of truth, and you know what you mean by truth, which most people in this world don't know today. Most people in most universities definitely do not know today, and most professors in most universities definitely don't know today, let alone the politicians and the newspapers. Therefore, if you have a principle of truth and know what you mean by universal truth, then you can use that in the form of how to construct Platonic dialogues, Socratic dialogues, to attack any problem with some insight into what will constitute truth. Therefore, you can then proceed by true dialogue, by maintaining an active, energetic dialogue on all kinds of issues. You can begin to sort out the truth from the garbage from the popular opinion. Then you can walk in with confidence anywhere and discuss almost anything if you're willing to go through that process with anybody else who is willing to go through the same process. And what we need in this planet now is a standard of truth to develop leaders of a stronger character, a stronger individual personal character, operating on the basis of a principle of truth, who can influence institutions. The institution, in the case of the United States and Europe, it particularly is the previous generation, the generation of baby boomers. Because the baby boomers were subjected to this terrible change in culture which took over beginning about 1964, the so-called rock, drug, sex counterculture, and the kinds of things that have come up since, and the kind of movements. And they became a now generation, which had lost the idea that truth lay, as it did for most earlier generations among responsible, moral people. Truth used to mean that what you were doing today, as an adult in particular, was going to be good for the next two generations to come. Therefore, you have a future orientation as opposed to a now generation orientation. You look at your children and grandchildren as a point of reference for this kind of achievement. We've lost that. Therefore, what they have to do in a time of crisis, when the baby boomer generation is faced with the fact that its ideology was wrong, its opinion was wrong, its behavior was wrong, is to confront them with evidence that there is truth. And but since anyone who's got any grains of sensitivity at all knows that my grandchildren's generation, which is what these young people represent, my grandchildren's generation is my future. The meaning of what I do lies in what they represent as my future, and what comes out of the generation that comes from them. Therefore, anybody, including the baby boomer, confronted with that kind of evidence, can respond and say, look, our generation has a future. The baby boomer generation in the United States and Europe is a generation which is believed that it has no future. And they're right, as the present Iraq war reflects that. But if the older generation, which has been blocked on this, which has accepted the now generation principle, which has gone along, sees young people of their children's age moving, you'll move the older people.
Because people are moved by that, because they're human. People are moved by their children and grandchildren, or by people who might have been their children and grandchildren. They're moved by that in any part of the world. People are moved when they go to Africa and see the suffering. They're moved by the children. They're moved by the youth with no future. Their morality is disturbed by this spectacle. And therefore, a youth movement which is able to convey a sense of truth, a universal principle of truth, of the type which has been typified by the case of Gauss's paper. That is a powerful force. We've never had a youth movement in modern times of that type. I think we should have had it. Why not? Get some examples of what other things apply there. There are two dimensions of truth by the Gauss standard. One is the truth as it pertains, as in physical science, to the relationship of the individual mind acting upon the universe, which we usually call physical science. The second one is the way in which society, using these ideas of physical science, is able to act socially and effectively upon the universe, the universality of existence. Therefore, there are only two kinds of truth. This kind of truth, individual relationship to nature truth, on the one level, and social relations, which pertain to man's relationship to nature and to man. And therefore, the principle of truth applies to both. And we have to have a society which rejects Kant, which recognizes that Kant was the thing that poisoned Germany the most, next to the existentialists, and he helped to create them. And then we have to go to a principle of atomic principle of truth instead. Now, the six cases on the social side of the kind of poison which destroys society. Let's take the little green men theory, which is what every most economists teach. What every free market person in any law teaches is their independent opinion of as stupidity of their independent opinion. What is the base is based on? Well, it's based on logic empiricism in modern times, particularly the empiricism of Hobbes. But the more famous one, the more relevant to our concern here, and not Hobbes, but rather people like John Locke. A real potential fascist is called liberal. That's why liberals sometimes turn into fascists, like down the shot. Kinney, the physiocrat. Adam Smith, Bernard Mandeville, and other creatures of the British East India Company, such as Jeremy Bentham. These people's theory is all based on the theory that the universe is actually controlled by little green men operating under the floorboards of reality. And these fellows, who are, with their invisible hands, are fixing the dice, the throw of the dice, to make some people wealthy and powerful and others destitute and miserable. And that's the theory. It's the theory of free trade. There's nothing to it but that. This is what Mandeville said. This is what Locke said. This is what Adam Smith taught, this is what Kinney taught, this is what Tagore taught, look what it did for France. But people believe. So we have to believe in free trade. Are you against freedom? Freedom of who? The little green man on the floorboards with the invisible hands? Example. Then people say, well, you have to go by opinion. Well, I know most of the opinion that is expressed in most parts of the world on most subjects is idiotic. Now, if the majority of opinion is one kind of identity or another, why should I be debating myself on opinions instead of truth? What we should base ourselves on is what? What does truth boil down to? Now, let me get a little bit tough. I've done this before, but on this question, it's crucial to understand my point. Mankind is different than any other type of living creature. Mankind is the only creature capable of reason. Because mankind, and how does mankind reason? Mankind realizes that his senses fool him. The person who says, I believe in sense perception, is a fool. He's behaving like a monkey. Like the case of the Malaysian monkey who ended up on the farmer's dinner table. Malaysian monkey. The Malaysian farmer was clever. He wanted to eat monkey at night. So he would take an earthen flask or another flask, and he would put a nut, which the monkey would like, in the flask. He would tie a rope around the neck of the flask and leave it there. The monkey would come along, find the nut, put the paw in, grab the nut, but then the monkey couldn't get the nut hand out of the flask while holding the nut. And since the monkey wouldn't give up the nut, the farmer would come along and catch monkey, nut, and all, and take them home for dinner. Not as guests, but as on the table. Not at the table, but on the table. So, animals are like that. Animals have animal insight, but they couldn't solve the monkey trap problem. And every hunter can tell you that. Every professional hunter, experienced hunter. How do you hunt an animal? Not by chasing it. You hunt an animal by knowing how the animal functions. You know where the animal is going to be, and you're there waiting for it with the appropriate arrangements. And that's how you get the animal. Every animal can be taken by that way, and all too many human beings are taken that way because they choose to look like animals. The difference is the animal responds to sense perception as reality. Now, when human beings enter into relation to that animal, it's how the world should respond to it. Like this pet dog. The relationship between the human being and the pet animal pet changes the character of the animal because it is now coupled with human behavior and will respond to its sense perception to the influence of human behavior and will behave unlike an animal of the same species in nature. But generally, animals operate simply on the basis of sense perception and what appears to be their genetic predetermination. Huh? Human beings, on the other hand, know that sense perception is a fraud, or they come to know it. They realize that what your senses show you is not the meaning of the universe outside your skin. What the senses show you is the reaction of a certain part of your biological processes, called sense perceptions, to the stimulus provided usually by the outside world. Therefore, you will never see the outside world with your senses. What you have to do is you have to solve the problem of discovering what actually is out there that causes the effect. And how can you control what is out there to change the effect? Only human beings as a species can do that. Animals can't. What man discovers, for example, is principle we call physical principles. Principles of the universe, which are not visible. You can never smell a principle. I hope not. You can never see one. Never taste it. But never touch it. A principle is something which the mind recognizes, not the senses. It recognizes by understanding what's wrong with the senses, and then learn how to use that principle to operate on the universe, the unseen universe, to cause the unseen universe to change in a way which is desired by a sense-perceiving individual. These discoveries, principles, are universal physical principles. The falseness of the idea of principle is typified by Cartesian or Euclidean geometry. You can learn something from these geometries, but don't take them on good faith. Or especially a Cartesian geometry. There are no definitions, a priori definitions, axioms, or postulates in the real world which are valid in the real world. Now this point was made by Kestner. It was made in the case of Gauss, it was made emphatically by Riemann in the opening of his famous habilitation dissertation. There are no abstract a priori principles in the universe. The only principles we know are those which are discovered as valid principles, universal principles. These are physical principles. They are physically efficient principles because by operating on them, we can produce changes which otherwise cannot occur. And therefore, all we know, the only geometry that is true, is a geometry which is based on discovered, valid, universal principles. Any other geometry is false. Any other principles are false. In the case of mankind, this is the basis for real or physical economy, as opposed to the garbage I referred to up here on these charts. How does mankind do what? How does mankind increase the relative potential population density of the human species as an act of will? If man were a higher ape, then under the conditions which existed on this planet during the recent 2 million years of the glacial cycle that we know, the total population of these apes called men would never exceed several million individuals. We now have over 6 billion people living on this planet. We could support 25 billion with comfort if we would apply the technology we have. And there's no limit to what we can do beyond that. Therefore, it is by man's will, the creative will, the power to discover and apply universal principles, that mankind is able to change his relationship to the universe to improve the condition of mankind and to increase man's power in the universe. Therefore, in physical economy, that is the principle of physical economy. This means, of course, a certain kind of education, a standard. It means conditions of life in which these mental powers of the young individual are fostered. It means the opportunities of work in which these mental powers can be called into play. It means the transmission of knowledge of these principles, which means rediscovery of these principles. And that is real economy. We now have a situation on this planet, in which if we go with a science-driver approach to the planet, using these kinds of principles, we can create a new condition of mankind on the planet. Now, to some of that, my points now, some of them fall away. These improvements, which we generate as mankind, are never less than the work of the generation. The fundamental capital investment is the investment society, including the family, make in developing a newborn baby into a mature adult capable of functioning economically or otherwise. Today, in modern society, that's about 25 years. In other words, to provide the kind of education and nurture which will ensure that a person comes out of education as a qualified young professional is an investment of society for about 25 years, a quarter of a century today. Therefore, the first policy of society should be that. That's your first level of capital investment. The second thing, out of the several levels of capital investment, is the basic economic infrastructure. Make the desert bloom. Improve water management. Increase forestation. More water, more power. These are things which also are capital investments, which require time. To build a large water system will take the period of a generation or longer to develop it fully. To build a power plant will probably take 4 years, a good power plant. 3 years if we're lucky. These things require capital investments. Where the cost of these things have to be averaged out over a number of years, half a generation or a full generation. Major power system, major transportation system, is an investment in a generation's time. These are capital investments. We must put the effort in to get a quarter century benefit or longer out of it. So physical capital is what's important. The level and quality of education are what's important. The level of health care is important. Disease control, public sanitation, these things are urgent. And otherwise, to get out and